The Connection is next.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the minds of many of us, the swing to citizens' rule began with Proposition 13, the move by California voters back in 1978 to regain control of their property taxes. Those who track ballot initiatives take us back another century to the late 1800s, when the first states began opening up to such direct involvement. Ballot initiatives and referenda helped women get the vote. They helped raise the minimum wage. They have been a tool of the right, those battling against abortion and big government, and a tool of the left with the push for animal rights, legal POC, and clean elections. Now, ballot initiatives increasingly are becoming a tool of the politicians themselves and of corporate interests. Education reform, tax reform, all to appear in dozens of initiatives in the upcoming election. Connection listeners, the ballot initiative used to be a tool for the people. Is that in any jeopardy as big money and big politics moves in? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from a couple of people who are very familiar with the initiative process, its history, and the controversies surrounding it. But first, let's go to Florida, where a furious debate is going on right now. It's over a ballot initiative that would reduce class size to 25 in public schools. And joining me are State Senator Kendrick Meek. He's chairman of Florida's Coalition to Reduce Class Size, and Ed Moore, who's a member of the Coalition to Protect Florida. That's an organization fighting the change. Senator Meek, let me start with you. You've got a seat in the Senate. You have a lawmaker's privileges there. Why not limit class size using those tools that you have as an elected representative?
Well, that's very interesting that you would ask that question with me being a creature of the Florida legislature for some 8 years now. I can tell you the reason why. There's individuals that are involved in the special interest community and legislators who say they want to reduce class size but don't really hold that as a principle or a strong philosophy. Mm-hmm. Everyone says we should do it, but they said, you know, it would be a nice thing to do, but we can't. We get elected, we go out and we say every November that we're going to reduce class size, like our governor's race right now. We have people that are saying that, but I can tell you right now that it won't. We tried to do it through the legislature. They said, well, we shouldn't put this in the statute. And then we tried to do it through a joint resolution that would have had the legislative input to be able to put it on the ballot, and they didn't want to do that. So the last resort, and we exercised all of that, exhausted all of that, we went to the people of the state of Florida, got over 600,000 petition signed to reduce the class size here in the state. And so that's the reason why it's going to be on the ballot this upcoming November for the people of the state of Florida to vote on, that I must add that a supermajority of them favors.
Now, I've read that the standards in Florida schools aren't great. The failure rates are too high, dropout rates among the worst in the nation, and that support for this idea runs somewhere around 75%. Is that right?
That's you're 100% correct. We're 50th in per capita spending in public education, 49th in graduation rates, 46th in SAT scores, and 44th as it relates to having a small class size in the state of Florida. We had 57,000 students, fourth graders, fail the reading portion of our assessment test here called the FCAT. So there's a great level of frustration here, and our class sizes are really getting to the point of upwards of the higher 30s in the lower grades, and as you go get a little higher, it really gets into the lecture halls. So with the growth that we're having here in the state of Florida, it's important that the people have an opportunity to vote on what they believe that's important. Smaller class sizes will help us in teacher recruitment and also making sure that we have classes where teachers can teach and children can learn.
Let's see if we can. Ed Moore, this sounds like something that's kind of hard to fight against. You're with the Coalition to Protect Florida, which is an organization pushing back against this limit. What are you standing on? What's your case?
Well, I would say that while the argument on its face sounds like mom and apple pie, it's sort of like asking the people if they'd be in favor of world peace. The reality is that it's a very, very expensive initiative with no real foundation or empirical fact. Studies after studies are conflicting as to whether the primary emphasis ought to be class size. And frankly, we would rather see a lot more money being placed in the human assets of education, which would be teachers. This amendment's going to require hiring about close to 32,000 new teachers that are not available. There's a teacher shortage in certain areas now, particularly in inner city communities where it's difficult to attract teachers. This is not the solution. It's not this wonderful solution that it's being painted out to be.
One of the things that I've read about it is that it could raise taxes by as much as $3 billion a year to fund what you're describing there. But what I'm interested in hearing from you on is what it's like fighting against this as a ballot initiative. If public support is running as the senator describes it, then in one sense, isn't it right to let the people have their say and then figure out where the money's going to come from after that?
Well, if you have that process in place, frankly, I'm more of a fan of the legislative process than Senator Meek expressed. I think having the filters and the consideration that the legislature provides does set priorities for the state. I mean, that's what this nation's been founded on. And it takes time. Sometimes you need to attack issues from multiple ways. There are various constituencies that all think have different ideas as to how we ought to go about attacking these kinds of issues. Placing something that's, as I said, is like a mom and apple pie on the ballot, saying, "Oh, are you in favor of more smaller classes?" Well, yeah, who would say no?
Okay,
but should that be how we set our educational priorities in Florida? I don't think so.
Senator Meek, Ed Moore's being polite. I've read people saying that you're downright irresponsible doing it this way.
Well, I can tell you what's irresponsible is, as we speak right now, having a teacher to be in a classroom where set standards and saying that a class size has to perform at a certain level. In Florida, a law just kicked in saying if a third grader can't read at a certain level that they have to stay behind. But then again, we have them in lecture halls are truly unfair. And as we look at the legislative process, it's manipulated and polarized by special interests. I mean, adult entertainment is a tax exempt here in the state, and we have almost $23 billion every year that's tax exempted. And also, we had some voices in Tallahassee that stood against tax exemption reform. And I think this will put those exemptions on the table under the spotlight for those that are not generating jobs or serving a real true benefit to Floridians. Well, hopefully be pushed to the side and put these dollars put into the public education, into the schools. And I think that's very, very important. It's nothing irresponsible about it. What's happening irresponsibly right now is the situation that we're in. We are at the dead last in the country in what we invest in public education, and I think that's nothing to be proud of.
Senator and Ed Moore, I want to thank you for taking the time to explain this to us. We'll be watching what happens on voting day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's State Senator Kendrick Meek, chairman of Florida's Coalition to Reduce Class Size. Ed Moore is a member of the Coalition to Protect Florida. What they're arguing about is a ballot initiative, which Florida voters will be looking at on voting day on the 5th to decide whether or not class sizes should be limited to 25. And let's turn now to Dane Waters, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute. It's a nonprofit research organization. Dane's in Washington. Lane Shetterly is also with us. He's a Republican member of the Oregon House of Representatives, and he's joining us from Portland. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good morning.
Dane Waters, let me start with you. Your organization tracks the evolution of ballot initiatives, and the one that we've just heard described in Florida sounds like a drift that or a direction where the whole thing's drifting.
Well, I mean, if you look at the history of the initiative process, as you were talking about earlier, it started in the late 1800s, and the first statewide initiative was in 1904. And since then, there have been 2,006 statewide initiatives on the ballot. Now, as far as state lawmakers using the process or proposing initiatives, and there's a long, rich history of elected officials who can't get their reform through the state legislature turning to the initiative process because they see that that's the only mechanism in which they can get the reform that they truly believe in. And I think that what's happening in Florida is how the initiative process was intended, that if a reform can't be made possible through the normal legislative process, you have that opportunity to turn to the initiative process and take it directly to the people. So I don't think that it's wrong that a state lawmaker has turned to that process.
Lane Shetterly, in Oregon, I think you guys are out at the front of the pack with 7 people's initiatives on the ballot for November 5th. Am I right about that?
That is the number we have on the ballot. It's down substantially from what we had 2 years ago.
What's the range, though? Are you concerned at all about some of the stuff that people will be looking at, or are they all pretty well on the mark from your point of view?
Well, my issue, I think, that we need to discuss, first we need to step back and recognize that representative democracy really is the foundation of the American system of government, and within that system of government, you have the legislative process that has the checks and balances within it. It's a bicameral process. You're dealing with the executive, and it includes a strong element of restraint of the majority, a recognition and acknowledgement of minority interests that can frustrate many who want to see legislation on a fast track and get things done quickly and easily. The initiative process is much more a creature of direct democracy, and in that case, it really is pure majoritarianism, where the winner takes all the marbles. And in that sense, there's a tension, I think, between the fundamental structure of government as envisioned by the founders and where the initiative takes us, which is more toward direct democracy that the founders looked at and rejected.
But the range of choices that people in Oregon will be looking at, what sort of things
will
they be covering?
Oh, I think the range of choices that people will be looking at in Oregon are fairly typical of what you'd see around the country. Healthcare issues. We've got some couple of initiatives dealing with the election of judges on the ballot. We have a minimum wage initiative on the ballot. And the denturists are before us this year with an initiative that would authorize denturists to make dentures without the intervention of dentists. So that's an issue that we'll be voting on statewide as well.
And you're saying that it's actually not the right way to make laws. It's too close to mob rule at its worst?
Well, I'm saying there's a tension between the initiative process and representative democracy that is the foundation of our form of government. That's not to say that it's evil. That's not to say that it's bad and that it doesn't accomplish good things. I think that states just need to recognize that tension and that we as a society need to recognize that there are limits and constraints that we should put on the initiative process, just as we expect on the legislative process, so that one doesn't get out of control.
Tell me, Dane Waters, whether or not we're seeing, though, a slight reduction in the number of ballot initiatives across the country as various legislatures have tightened up the rules for how to get one on the ballot.
We're definitely seeing a decrease. I mean, this will be the lowest number of initiatives on the ballot since 1986, a 30% decrease from the last election cycle. Oregon, there's a 70% decrease than 2000. And this is all can be related to or tied to the increased regulations and restrictions on the initiative process, which I will add has increased the amount of money in the initiative process, which has made it such that really individuals with access to money can use the process, and the average citizen doesn't have access to utilize the initiative process.
Is that squeezing some of the democracy out of it then, if cash gets you access?
Well, I'm not one of those guys who believe that money is inherently evil, and so I don't have a problem with individuals with money utilizing the initiative process personally. I just think that lawmakers, you know, as Lane has talked about when I've seen him before, that, you know, there's so much money in the initiative process, you know, that we need to regulate and restrict it and get it back to how the people originally thought the process should be utilized. But the reality is that the courts, the Supreme Court has ruled that you cannot limit the amount of money in the initiative process, no matter what rules and regulations you have, rich individuals will be able to use it. We need to open it up for the average citizen to utilize the process.
Connection listeners, ballot initiatives coming up in the next vote. Your sense of whether or not the system is still there for the average voter, the way to influence and affect politics, whether or not it's moving too far to special interests. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Dane Waters, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute. It's a nonprofit educational and research organization based in Washington. And Lane Chatterley's with us. He's a Republican member of the Oregon House of Representatives, House Speaker Pro Tem. We're talking about ballot initiatives, the principle and the change that we're watching. And if you go through the checklist of things that people will be voting on, Mr. Chatterley talks about the denturists wanting the ability to make dentures in Oregon. There's an initiative in Idaho, where voters want to reintroduce term limits that the state politicians voted dropped. In Arizona, there's an attempt to open up gaming beyond Aboriginal control. In Florida, they want to ban gestation crates for pigs. And so on it goes. Cockfighting to be banned in Oklahoma. Lots on the docket. Now, if that's the way that things are supposed to work, Dane Waters, then do we want fewer controls on what gets to go on the ballot? Should the state legislatures be looking at ways of restricting or demanding more signatures? What's your sense of where we're going with this?
Well, I believe that that we need to there are certain regulations and reforms that should take place regarding the initiative process, and the National Conference of State Legislatures issued a report that Lane was part of that had some good recommendations dealing with the technical aspects of the initiative process. But I believe that, you know, the average citizen, for example, in California, you need to collect 1 million signatures to put an issue on the ballot out there. I mean, I may be a great guy, but I don't think I can have enough friends to go out and collect 1 million signatures. So I think that we need to create a process in which the citizens can go out and work with their fellow citizen to try to put these issues on the ballot. You need to lengthen the amount of time you have to collect signatures. For example, in California, you have 180 days. In Massachusetts, you have, 90 days.
Right.
In Oklahoma, you have 64 days. I mean, that's a short period of time to collect these signatures to put these issues on the ballot. So, I mean, the citizens have been very prudent in putting issues on the ballot. As I said, there's only been a little over 2,000. The citizens only adopted a little over 800 of them. So I think that we should open up the process to make it more accessible to the average citizen to put the issues on the ballot that they care about.
Lane, do you agree with that?
Well, I do agree fundamentally with Dane that these are issues that need to be carefully looked at, and I think Dane and I probably agree actually on more than we disagree on. I do think that he touched on an area that's going to be an issue of growing concern if Oregon is any indication, and that is the signature gathering process and the integrity of that. During the 1990s, we saw the introduction of money as we had never seen it before in the initiative process, particularly in the signature gathering phase, and the advent of paid signature gatherers, the payment being made on a per signature basis.
Can you just clarify that for me? Does that mean that I can actually go and hire a company to gather signatures on whatever I want to put at the top of a piece of paper?
Sure. It's what I call the initiative industry. You have companies that exist for that purpose, basically to shop initiatives and then find sponsors to fund the signature gathering. They hire the signature gatherers, and there's very much a business orientation to this now, much less than the real grassroots kind of citizen-directed initiative that we had for most of the century. What this has created has been, I think, an incentive for fraud. And in fact, in Oregon, we just had a civil racketeering trial concluded against one of the major initiative proponents. And one of the elements, excuse me, of that trial featured forged signatures and the testimony being that with the profit motive on a per signature basis, you have incentivized signature gatherers
right.
to forge signatures to generate them. And that raises then the entire question as to whether initiatives are getting on the ballot with truly the level of support that is required or whether there are questions about the integrity of those petitions.
But this went to the Supreme Court, what, Dane, in 1988 to test whether or not paid signature gathering was in fact democratic?
That's true. There's been two important U.S. Supreme Court cases. Several states Colorado tried to ban paying signature gatherers altogether. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it was an infringement of the First Amendment. This pay-per-signature ban, which is now being considered in Oregon through the initiative process, actually, which would say you can't pay per signature, but you can pay by the hour. There's some constitutional questions with that as well. And one thing that Lane talks about and a lot of individuals talk about is that, just because you pay somebody per signature does not necessarily mean that they're more likely to commit fraud. I mean, there's been instances where people strongly support and volunteer for efforts where they have an incentive because they're zealots on the issue to commit fraud. I mean, democracy is messy. You're going to have individuals out there who abuse the process. On average, over 3 million signatures are collected in this country every election cycle, and a very, very small percentage of those actually turn out to be fraudulent. And, there are checks and balances to find those fraudulent signatures. And I would maintain, for example, you have in the U.S. Congress, Dan Roskinkowski's individuals who break laws and commit fraud. We don't hear people advocating we do away with representative government. So you're going to have fraud in the initiative process. It's a nature of the beast. You're going to have fraud in any democracy, but I don't think that fraud rises to the level to impose the regulations and restrictions that are being considered across the country.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's start in Roslindale, Massachusetts. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment. It's ironic that we're talking about the subversion of the referendum process by individuals or interested third parties right now, when at least here in Massachusetts, it would appear to me to be the state legislature that is primarily guilty of abusing or ignoring the process. We have the famous example of the publicly funded campaigns. The legislature basically just blew that completely off, and it was a big, big controversy here over the last year. And in this round, we have a ballot initiative, a non-binding advisory question, which the legislature changed the rules for how it's going to be displayed on the ballot in order to favor the outcome that they want to get. This is, I'm talking about the taxpayer funding for political campaigns initiative.
Right. I think I want to pick up the first point that you made, Jeff, because it's one that I was puzzling over prior to the program, and I mean, it seems, Lane Shetterly, maybe you can start on this, that you know, when the taxpayers, when the voters do speak, the state legislatures aren't necessarily, certainly in Massachusetts, haven't felt obliged to do that, even after being batted about the ears by the courts or dragging their feet. Does that mean that at one level, it's not really democracy?
I think it depends. It's probably a different situation from state to state. Certainly, if what you're talking about is a voter-approved constitutional amendment, that is going to take effect, and it's going to be difficult for a legislature to overlook that. On the other hand, you may have situations, and I don't know the Massachusetts situation directly, but publicly funded campaigns. I think that presents an issue of another problem with the initiative process in how it coordinates with the rest of the function of government. When you have initiatives that create obligations for state funding, whether it be for campaigns, whether it be for healthcare systems, whether it be for small class sizes, but yet at the same time don't put new revenue into the state budget to deal with that, sometimes what those can do is to force choices that voters may not have intended, where they direct programs or spending in one direction or another, and yet at the same time don't provide for offsetting cuts or new revenues, and that can force legislatures to make choices even in the face of adopted initiatives.
Well, in Massachusetts, they can just completely, it's not that they just completely ignored the initiative. I mean, they refused to bring it up on the floor. They refused to discuss it. Finally, they had to be taken to court, and it was a huge mess. So,
but Jeff, I mean, eventually they were selling off pickup trucks in order to get the money.
Because they refused to talk about how to fund it. I mean, that is their job, is to manage the state finances, at least in part. That's a big part of their job. And they refused to do that when they were directed by the citizens to, we want you to address this topic. We want you to do this. Find a way to fund it. And they refused to do that. And they had to be brought to court to basically pay attention to the issue that the people had said, we want you to do this.
Jeff, let's listen to Dane Waters for a minute.
Oh, okay.
Well, let me throw this out. You know, Massachusetts is one of those states where the initiative process cannot be used to appropriate funds, which is how the state legislature there is getting away with not actually implementing the clean election laws there. They also have failed to implement the last round of a tax cut that was passed through the initiative process. And many argue that if the initiative that cuts the state income tax or abolishes the state income tax passes, they'll probably choose maybe not to enforce that. I mean, this is actually an issue that I'm somewhat conflicted on, because even though the initiative process is a check and balance on representative government is also a check and balance on the initiative process. I mean, it's the inherent responsibility of state lawmakers to decide what is in the best fiscal interest of the state. So on one hand, even though I may disagree with them failing to fund specific initiatives passed through the initiative process, you have to respect them in some way, if their motives are true, to make the hard choices, decide, well, you know, this is just not fiscally in the best interest of the state. It's a tough call.
And then you vote them out of office if they're not doing what you want them to do.
Well, that's right. You can vote them out of office. In some states, like in Oregon, I'm sure Lane can attest to this, where the legislature has changed certain initiatives. The voters have gone back to the ballot and reinforced that they wanted that issue again. I mean, lawmakers across the country, when Lane talks about how the lawmakers' hands are tied, in many instances, they have the ability and the authority to to change an initiative, to choose not to implement it. If it's a constitutional amendment, it's a different story. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they have some options with that as well.
Jeff, last word to you. Do you think, though, even with all its flaws, that the ballot initiative system that exists in Massachusetts is more accessible to you as a voter than some piece of legislation that might be introduced on the floor of the State House?
Yes, it is. But I see year by year that it's getting co-opted by the legislature. So I do. I'm in favor of the referendum process. And, by the way, I wasn't in favor of that particular referendum that I was talking about. So.
Right.
My outrage was more about the process being subverted.
The way they responded to it. Thanks
exactly.
for your call.
Thank you.
To Beaver Dam, Wisconsin now, and Justin's on the line. Hi, Justin.
How's it going?
Good.
My comment goes back to the, you know, you're talking about the state's right or the national rights. My comment or question, with the medical marijuana initiatives that were passed in the states over the past couple of years.
Where states have said, yes, they would allow the distribution of medical marijuana, and it all flies in the face of DEA laws, right?
Right. And, you know, the states, I used to live in Colorado when that initiative was passed, and it was passed an overwhelming majority in Colorado. And then for the federal government to overturn, you know, those states' rights to decide those laws governing those states. You know, I think mostly because of the lobbyists, but, you know, I don't know. I just don't think that it's, I like the initiative process. I just don't like the fact that the national government can then overturn, you know, what the state is deciding for their state.
Lane, is that just one immovable force meeting another immovable force?
Well, I think it's several forces coming together. We do live in a federalist society where we do have federal constitution, federal laws that preempt state laws, and we live with that. That's just a fact. That's part of the social compact that we live under in this country. In Oregon, we've had a similar situation. Frankly, we passed what we call the Death with Dignity law. It was an initiative that authorizes doctors to assist suicide. And that initiative has been up before Congress, coming under the laws dealing with controlled substances, and now is under a legal challenge by the U.S. Department of Justice. And so we do face that, whether it be in marijuana, whether it be in Death with Dignity, or others. But again, that is part of the messy process of government
right.
in this country. That is designed, I think, into the system to sometimes slow things down. I think our founders were, frankly, fearful of government that might be too efficient, too quick on its feet, too quick to recognize the majority movement in one direction or another. And frankly, I'm satisfied that over time these things work themselves out.
One of the ballot initiatives, Dane Waters, in South Dakota, I think, would give voters or has voters weighing in on whether or not sentencing can be altered in circumstances that would, I've heard the medical marijuana or possession of marijuana brought up as a case where someone gets to make a case to the jury that, yeah, I broke the law. It's not a very good law, so can I just go home now, please? Is that a way of getting around this head knocking that Justin's describing?
Well, you know, the problem, it boils down to a whole state's rights issue. I mean, the drug policy reform movement, their whole strategy has been similar to the women's suffrage movement and the abolishment of poll tax movement, where you put these issues on as many state ballots as you can, you raise public awareness, public debate, you know, and then maybe in some way that may force Congress to act. In South Dakota, I mean, the drug policy reform movement, I mean, because they've run into problems with the DEA saying that you cannot, you know, have medical marijuana, you cannot legalize marijuana in any way or certain controlled substances. They're arguing now that in state courts, this wouldn't pertain to federal court, but in state courts, you could argue the merits of the law. Like if I'm caught with marijuana or some other controlled substance, I can argue the merits of the law. And even though I may technically be guilty of possession, yet the jury could find that the law is not a valid law and basically let me off the hook. So that I believe, will probably be the next front in the drug policy reform movement out there.
I want if I can, go back to a point that we were talking about a little earlier, and that is the money side of it. Because, Dane, in the information that your organization's put out, it seems like there is a shift. I'm talking about Jeff's point about Massachusetts and where the money's going to come from. It does seem like there is a shift to use ballot initiatives as a way of raising money, of you know, hitting sin taxes on cigarettes, tobacco, things like that. Is that new?
It's not new. I mean, there's always, you know, anybody who wants a social reform of any kind, if you looked at the history of the initiative process, I mean, they go after certain revenue streams to try and tap into to fund specific issues. I mean, you look at the tobacco settlement funds out there, which is a basically a 20-year stream of money in many states. You've seen several initiatives tapping into that, and you're going to continue to see over the years people tapping into that because they see it as a revenue stream. When people propose initiatives, in most cases, when at all possible, I mean, they do try to propose some way to fund these specific issues. And it may cause conflict in the state legislature. But, you know, sin taxes, taxing cigarettes, taxing alcohol, you know, and the state of Washington, I don't know if it was ever placed on the ballot, but in Seattle they were looking at an espresso tax, 10 cents on every shot of espresso to pay for certain health care reforms there. So people go after things that they see as a potential revenue stream to try and pay for these reforms because people don't want the state legislature to raise taxes, so they do try to find other ways to fund these reforms.
Lane Chatterley, just briefly, because we're coming up to a break, though, it seems that a number of elected legislators are using the ballot initiative process to float tax hikes and saying, you know, let's put it straight to the people. And some people are saying that's chicken. You should do it in the legislature. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think as long as you have the initiative process, you're going to have people using it. And I'm not surprised that you would have people involved, even in elected positions, getting in the initiative system. Tempting to do that, especially if you're a legislator who may not have had success in advancing a particular agenda through the cumbersome legislative process. You try to define it in such a way that it makes a good package for an initiative, and you go out and you hire a signature gathering company to get the signatures, and you put it on the ballot. Again, I think that just underscores the difference between the legislative process and the initiative. I don't think that makes the initiative better. I think that our system is still better when these issues have to be worked out through the give and take and compromise and amendment process that you see typically in the legislature.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're talking about the differences between the legislative process, where the balance of power is supposed to make sure that the construction of laws is done judiciously, and the initiative process, a little more unruly. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about ballot initiatives, what's coming up on the November 5th ballot, and how is it different from the ballots that have come before? What can we say and see that's changing in the process? With me on the program, Lane Chatterley. He's a Republican member of the Oregon House of Representatives in his third term. And Dane Waters, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute. He's also founder and president of Americans for Sound Public Policy. That's another nonprofit organization. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston. Owen's on the line. Hi, Owen.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. My name is Owen Egan, and as a full disclaimer, I'm the campaign manager for No on Question 2 here in Massachusetts.
Question 2 is the bilingual education question on the ballot, right?
That's correct. I have to applaud you for this discussion because I think it's an important one. And I'm generally in favor of the ballot initiative process, but I think the populists and the progressives that initiated this process at the turn of the 20th century would be turning over in their graves if they had seen what the process had evolved into. It's come full circle from a tool that was intended to give voters greater freedom into a tool that's used by wealthy individuals and special interests to advance their own causes.
Now, in the case of bilingual education, you're talking about Ron Unz. His English for Children campaign started back in 98, pushed again in 2000, now in 2002. And what's wrong? Oh, and if the guy's got a lot of money and an idea that he wants to push, if he uses that to try and get the attention of voters?
Well, I think it's you know, it's a matter of money and access. You know, paid signature gatherers are protected constitutionally, but there's a problem with that, in that people with access to great amounts of money can get whatever initiatives they want to advance their own personal agendas. This program that question two would advance, English immersion, let me just back up and tell you what question two would do. It would mandate a one-size-fits-all approach for all English learners in the Commonwealth. And it's been a proven failure in California. And not only that, but the legislature just passed a comprehensive overhaul of bilingual education that would allow school districts to decide which programs best suit their kids' needs, and it would provide strict accountability so that schools could even be taken over if they were underperforming. They just passed this law in August.
Let me interrupt you if I can. Is part of your reluctance to embrace the process because you're just feeling outgunned by the slickness and the cash of the other side? Are you getting a chance to make to voters the case that you're making here on the radio about the substance?
Yeah, that's a great point, Dick. Unfortunately, in this day and age, the only way to get your message out is through money. And we are enjoying the support of Senators Edward Kennedy, John Kerry, all 10 U.S. representatives in the Congress, an overwhelming majority of elected officials in the state legislature. Jane Swift just signed the comprehensive bill. And despite that support, and despite the fact that Latinos and Hispanics and language minority groups want the best education for their students, despite that widespread grassroots support for this bill, Ron Unz is going forth with an initiative that would, that is based upon marketing puffery and a complete fallacy that every child learns the same way.
Oh, and just hang on a second, if you will, because I want to bring Dane Waters in here. Dane, is it accurate to say that your research shows that, in fact, money doesn't always win in these cases?
No, money does not win. I mean, the converse is true. The more money put into an initiative campaign, the more likely it is to lose. I mean,
The more money put in, the more likely it is to lose?
That's correct, because what happens is you have to look at the difference between candidate campaigns and initiative campaigns. In candidate campaigns, you know, typically the candidate who spends the most money in most cases wins. That's because voters who choose to vote have to choose between candidate A and candidate B. Okay,
right.
They have to make an informed choice. When it comes to a ballot measure, only 40% of them ever pass, primarily because the more money spent, it raises voter doubt. I mean, you're going to have the NEA and the Massachusetts Educational Association going out there saying this will harm public education. You're going to have Ron Unz out there saying it's going to benefit public education. I mean, when there's this conflict of messages, voters typically take the cautious route and say, I'm uncertain, so I'm going to maintain the status quo. So money is very instrumental in defeating an initiative. But there's actually every piece of academic research out there shows that the person who spends the most money, you can't buy a yes vote. It helps you with access to get on the ballot. But one thing I do want to point out, that no matter how many signature gatherers you want to hire, only Massachusetts citizens can sign that initiative, and only Massachusetts citizens can vote for that measure.
Oh, and you should be encouraged by that.
Well, I am and I'm not. I think, first of all, it's more difficult to pass an initiative. So to say that, initiatives only pass, to express a converse relationship between money and the passage of initiatives, I think is somewhat of a distortion, because a no vote is usually the easier case to make. But in our case, here is a very ambiguous and innocuous question on the ballot that would it's the wording of the language is something like, do you support an initiative that would provide all English instruction to English learners by having them taught all subjects in English? Well, everybody wants kids to learn English, but this is a complicated matter that should be deliberated in the legislature, and it has been, and it has been passed.
Oh, and I'm going to step in, if you don't mind, and move along, because we've got a few other callers, and I don't want to keep it stuck in just one issue, but thanks a lot for your call.
All nice right, thanks.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston, and Galen's on the line. Hi, Galen.
Hi, how are you, Dick?
Fine, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to echo some of Owen's concerns about the money, and this was raised a little bit earlier by Dane as well. It's certainly important for voters to have as much information about the economic interests behind ballot measures And it's also important for voters to know that this is an enormous political arena. Over $400 million was spent by ballot committees in 1998. That's significantly more money than was raised by both national political parties.
Should we be surprised by this, Galen? If people actually acknowledge that it's a process that can give them access to change or power, why wouldn't they then look for ways to put money into it?
Absolutely. I agree 100%, and I think we need to be even more concerned post-McCain-Feingold as all of those former six-figure check writers seek new paths to influence public policy. As you mentioned earlier, no state limits contributions to ballot measures. The disclosure laws for ballot initiative donors are considerably weaker than candidate donor disclosure practices.
Right.
And therefore, I think this presents those former soft money donors with a particularly attractive option to modify public policy through the initiative process. And if your listeners and voters want to learn more information about money and ballot measure campaigns, they should visit our website at ballotfunding.org.
Okay, thanks for the reference. Let's hear from Lane Shetterly here in terms of disclosure limits that Galen's talking about as you look at ways of regaining a little bit of control over the process. Is he talking about things that should be on the table?
I think those are on the table. Dane mentioned earlier in the program the task force that I worked with through the National Conference of State Legislatures that looked at the initiative process and made recommendations for improvement, and financial disclosure was one of the key areas that we focused on. I think that during the better part of the 20th century, when the initiative process was chugging along quietly as a mom-and-pop kind of grassroots effort, things were pretty quiet on the financial end. But as money came into it in the 90s, I think states are waking up to the need that the need to update their financial disclosure laws with respect to initiative campaigns and make them more consistent with the kinds of requirements we see in candidate campaigns. And I think that's good. I think that will help make the initiative process more transparent. And by making it more transparent, I think it'll be more useful to voters so they see where this money is coming from, who's behind the measures, and inform themselves that way just as they can other ways about the measure and the way they do about candidates.
All right, Galen, thanks for that call. To Chapel Hill, North Carolina now, and Nick's with us. Hi, Nick.
Yes, good morning, Dick. Thank you very much for a wonderful program.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. My comment, before, some people called in about referendums in Colorado and different places, and they were talking about the fact that because the voters wanted something a certain way, the majority wanted it a certain way, therefore it should be that way. The fact is that I'm old enough to remember the days of segregation, and the majority of people wanted segregation before the federal government stepped in and said, you can't do that anymore. So the majority is not always right. And sometimes we need a little more guidance from those people who are in office to direct us, even when we think we're doing the right thing.
Or at the very least, we need to have the confidence that those people who are elected and sitting in office will have the time to do the research and do some of the deep thinking that maybe is not being done at the street level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this refers to one of your guests who was talking about the fact that a democracy is messy, and the fact that we would like it to be pristine and clean, and it isn't.
But let me ask you something else, though, Nick, because I was wondering whether or not the trend towards being suspicious of politics and not trusting your politician is in a way a part of the swing towards ballot initiatives.
Well, I think we all want to be better informed. I want to have some kind of a dialogue, and I think what ballot initiatives do is it does sort of rattle the cage of our legislators and let them know that people are out there and that we are concerned about something. It's a little bit more of, I guess, what they call the sunshine policy. You know, let's have these discussions out in the open, regardless of the outcome.
Let's turn to Lane Shetterly. Lane, I mean, as I was looking through all the things that have been covered in referenda and ballot initiatives, I was drawn to ask you whether or not it would go to a point where we could just do away with elected legislatures and pass all the laws this way. I mean, I know it's a little absurd, but
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. Of course, we won't, although with technology, you do wonder sometimes whether we can just abolish the legislature and we all vote on issues on a daily basis through our PCs and Macs sitting on our desks at home.
Yeah.
Certainly, if we do that, we will have created a country that is different in fundamental ways from the country that our founders established. And I think we do need to be very careful about how fast and how far we move away from representative democracy. I think Nick's call touched on the issue of majoritarianism that I mentioned early in the program.
Right.
And in fact, it is true that our system was designed sometimes to frustrate the will of the majority, and that is a reality that we live with. But that also is what has helped kept this country stable for 2.25 centuries.
And yet, Dane, when we use Nick's example of segregation as not wanting the majority necessarily to have the rule, is it fair, when you look back over the history of ballot initiatives, to say that something that may be expressed as the will of the people in an initiative in the 1960s might actually not make it into law till the 1970s, but it's always a harbinger of the way that thinking is going?
Well, that's true. But one thing I want to point out, though, if you talk about segregation and the laws, I mean, the laws dealing with segregation were passed by state legislatures. And if you look at the history of the initiative process, you look at the process was used to empower minority rights. They were used to abolish poll taxes because the state legislatures, especially in states like Mississippi, Florida, and other states where they were definitely not going to pass any laws to empower certain individuals, the initiative process was the tool the citizens could use to break up that control. So
right.
We have to look at the source of these laws. But majority rule is just a system of government in which we have. I mean, state lawmakers put way more measures on the ballot than the citizens do. Those are passed in almost all instances by a simple majority rule. And no one ever complains about that. When the state legislature puts something on the ballot and it passes by 50% plus one, people don't question whether the citizens were competent enough or made the right decision. But when the citizens put an initiative on the ballot and it passes by 50% plus one, people like raise up and say, oh, that was just a bad decision to make.
Well, we'll be watching them on the 5th. And I thank Dane, you for your time on this program today.
Thank you.
And Lane Shetterly, thanks for coming in. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you. I was glad to be here.
Lane Shetterly is a member of the Oregon House of Representatives. Dane Waters, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute. Earlier in the program, we talked with Florida State Senator Kendrick Meek, chairman of the Coalition to Reduce Class Size, and Ed Moore, the Coalition to Protect Florida, which is just another way of saying that they actually don't like the idea of reducing class size, certainly not through a ballot initiative, something that we can all watch because it involves the president's brother as well in ways that are interesting to watch. A thanks today to Rex Recording Studio in Portland, Oregon, for the assistance there. Connection listeners, feel free to continue this conversation about ballot initiatives at the Democratic Forums of theconnection.org. Our programs produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugar. It's our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is